Good morning. The Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. We have two public hearings. We're going to start with House Bill 4084. We have a couple of state reps here to join us. We'll first take a brief staff summary on brown fields.
I didn't want to say that.
That is.
Is that Paul?
We're out.
Mazen.
No, I guess not, huh? Chris is
when says Mazen?
It's 4084, Mr. Chair, right?
4084. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 4084.
I'm going to do my Mazen motion.
I'm just checking to see. Keeping up around here is getting a little difficult, especially you guys in LRO.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill deals with brown fields, and you have two members here who can describe it much more accurately than I can.
Wow. Oh, good job.
Good morning, Chair Haas. Vice Chair Boquist and Vice Chair Barrett Sugar, members of the committee. My name is Caddy McEwen. I represent House District 9 down on the south coast of Oregon, Coos Bay to Yaha. It's inland to Mapleton and Scottsburg. I'm here today to bring a bill before you, House Bill 4084, that deals with brownfield redevelopment. This is a voluntary program. I think the key tenets of this bill are that it is a voluntary program. It is a local option. 75% of taxing authorities have to approve any district, whether it's a city, county, or port, that wish to offer an abatement to someone coming in to do brownfield redevelopment. And the abatement is on the value of the property cleanup, not on the development. This bill came out of the House Revenue Committee 8-0, with the vote being very positive, and it came across the House floor 58-0. So it's a bill that has been around for a couple of sessions now, and we've been working very hard with this bill to make it amenable, positive, a very good tool for cities, counties, and ports to entice people to come into our communities across the state and clean up properties that otherwise may sit idle and not provide those jobs that we all hope are going to continue to come to our rural communities, our larger communities, and our metro area. We've had great support from the Brownfields Coalition. It's been vetted. It's been amended. We've answered many, many questions about it to get it to this point, and we bring it to you today for your consideration.
Thank you. Rick Davis.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Representative John Davis from House District 26. The fight in 26th! It's a pleasure to be here today to talk to you about Brownfield's property tax incentives. House Bill 4084 comes out of the Brownfield Coalition suite of bills proposed during the 2015 session. And those of us in the House, I believe, may have spent a little more time with this concept, but originally the Brownfields Coalition had come forward with three concepts. The first was the land bank authority, which we did pass in 2015 as a legislature. The second was the brownfield property tax exemption program, which we did not pass. And the third was a brownfields income tax credit, which we did not pass. So we passed the first one, the land bank authority. This is not the third one. This is not the income tax credit. This is the property tax exemption. House Bill 4084 would authorize a city, a county, or a port voluntarily to adopt a property tax incentive program to spur the remediation of brownfield sites. It would require 75% of the taxing districts in the area, the school districts, the special districts, the cities, and the counties who would be subject to this exemption to authorize the exemption. And the actual tax abatement is limited to the actual costs paid by the property owner in remediating the brownfield site. So we like to talk a lot about sideboards or guidelines for property tax incentives or tax exemptions in this building. And I think what you have here in House Bill 4084 represents sort of a potpourri of all those types of sideboards we like to put on property tax exemptions. There's a 10-year sunset on the bill as well to see if this is going to be successful. Again, it's completely voluntary. It is only available to property owners who could prove they have not caused, contributed to, or exacerbated the contamination on the property. If the property is transferred, the new owner is eligible for the tax abatement, provided they continue to comply with the program. So here's how the program would work. And this is really effective, and Mazin gave some great testimony in the House Revenue Committee about this is really a program most effective for those properties and those brownfield sites that are at the margins. So those where the cost of cleanup is really too much to justify private development coming in and cleaning them up. Many, many sites in many, many communities throughout all of Oregon, rural communities, urban communities, we're thinking of things like old dry cleaning sites, old gas stations, old industrial sites. This is not necessarily the type of program that's targeted at the gigantic 200-acre old aluminum smelter. We are trying to target development of small brownfields who are at the margins of cost. So here's how it would work. A property owner who is really in a position of having little to no value on their property because the cost of cleaning up the contamination is so great would come forward, would develop a plan in conjunction with DEQ for cleaning up the property. That plan would involve estimates from engineers, from their contractors, and from the remediation consultants on how much the property tax cleanup would cost. That cleanup amount, that estimated cost, would be certified by the local government, submitted to the local government, and as the property owner begins spending that amount, those amounts that are estimated to be spent and then backed up, and as we true up what's actually spent as the remediation occurs, would be abated from property taxes that would be paid on any increased value in the property. There's a hypothetical that is posted to OLIS about how this might work. It's on this very fancy piece of paper. It's in the testimony in OLIS. I believe it was submitted by Randy Tucker. So if you look it up, it walks through a hypothetical example of how it works. I won't take the time to do that right now unless you'd like me to. But this kind of gives a great projection of what one single property that has a cleanup cost of $100,000 might look like and how it might work. Again, we have really tried to tailor this program to be something that will work for every community in Oregon. And there's also an additional piece. Local communities may add their own criteria to the exemption. So if local communities want to add a jobs requirement or other criteria, they can actually extend the time of the property tax abatement from 10 years to 15 years. And again, remember, the limiting factor is that even though a property tax abatement might last 10 or 15 years, it can never be greater than the actual cost paid for remediation. So I'd be happy to take any questions, and thanks for your time.
And Chair Hass, I might note that it was an unusual day on the floor of the House when Representative Davis and I submitted a floor letter. We actually had to put it on large paper because we couldn't get all the supporters' logos on it without adding additional size to the paper. So there's a tremendous amount of support out in the business community and with our cities and our counties, and a lot of support out there has been generated behind this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just forewarned, I'm in a rare mood this morning. Couple questions. I guess I'm looking from the fighting 26, since you were absent or excused the day. Obviously, you weren't fighting that day. I'm looking at the staff members. I think you gave a couple of examples in your district. Maybe Representative McEwen can give. Are there some examples like the old coal facilities down on the coast we're trying to target this at?
Vice Chair Boquist, I think the examples that I would use, the reason this got on my radar was during about a session ago when I listened to a presentation from DEQ and looked at the map across the state that showed all of the brownfields that have been identified. And whether it's in, you know, LeGrand or Lakeview or Medford or Coos Bay, there are a plethora of these little city blocks that had dry cleaners, that had camera shops where they were processing film, I'm going to use my father's business for an example. My father, for 40 years, ran an office supply business in Coos Bay, and he had the typewriter concession in town, so he sold and repaired typewriters for 30 years. Well, when you clean old typewriters, you use a lot of solvent. You have big tanks of solvent, and you dip them. And I would imagine in that piece of property where my dad dad's business was, there would be some issues. Right now it's been paved over, and there is a visitor center on top of it. So, but those are the examples of the things where I think this can be very, very valuable. Again, these are not the Superfund sites we're looking at. For me, and the reason I was interested in it is we all have in our community these little pieces of property that are just sitting there. A lot of them were old gas stations as well, as Representative Davis mentioned. But that's what kind of drove me to this, that we need jobs out in our rural communities. And some of these property development have such a cost on them that people aren't going after them and trying to develop those. So that's what drove the interest for me.
And I apologize. I skimmed through the bill, and I was not here last week, so I'm a little ignorant to several of the things other than I've heard much about the bill on your side. Is there a cap size limit on this of, you know?
It's capped to the cost of the cleanup.
Right.
Yeah.
And follow-up question? Is there any prevailing wage requirement in it? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, and if I could, as I was mentioning all the sideboards, guidelines that we've added, I forgot to mention a very important one, which is the clawback provision, that there is a provision that if a property is disqualified for either failure to clean up or if the property owner exacerbates the contamination, et cetera, the exemption that they received will be added back to the property tax rolls, and they will have to pay those abated property taxes.
And Chair Hass, I would also like to thank Randy Tucker from Metro has been very involved with this and done a lot of the legwork in making sure that the concerns that were brought forward were amended, were brought into this bill in the engrossed version. And he's done a tremendous amount of the legwork and is here to answer questions also if we have any technical questions that Representative Davis and I can answer.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, I also want to thank there's a number of environmental attorneys around the state who have submitted suggestions on this bill, who helped craft this bill, AOC, LOC, a couple of cities who've been deeply involved, the Department of Revenue. So there's been really quite a group who's worked together through the interim on developing this concept. I want to extend my thanks to them.
And we extend our thanks to you for being so diligent on this particular issue. Thanks. We have some people signed up here. Let me call up Garrett Rosenthal.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good morning, Chair Hass and members of the committee. I originally checked that I'm representing Tax Fairness Oregon, and
Start off with your name.
My name is Garrett Rosenthal, and I'm representing Tax Fairness Oregon. Originally, I signed up and checked against, but basically, we really think this is a great idea and a great bill in many regards, and just it's missing some sideboards, and so we wanted to comment on that. For the record, just as background, I'm an environmental consultant, and I've worked on brownfield sites in Oregon, Washington, California for approximately 40 years, so I'm familiar with the process. I am not an attorney, however. Our concerns, and I want to speak to basically four issues. The first caution is, of course, that we've been operating in this country for the last 30 or 40 years that basically the polluter pays. This changes that paradigm to a certain extent in that it says that basically the taxpayer is going to pay for certain situations. Now, we understand that local situations and local conditions may alter that, and I think it's a good idea to allow the cities and taxing authorities the discretion to make some of those decisions that the common good is better in some cases. In other words, they have to move forward. We're all in favor, and I'm all in favor personally, of cleaning up brownfield sites. There's 1,200. Probably the large majority of them are small sites, such as cleaning, dry cleaners, gas stations, service stations, small repair shops, and so forth like that. I think it's a very good thing for the cities to have the option of cleaning these things up. Our key points go to several things, and we think that should be sideboards that were either perhaps omitted or whatever. First of all, as you know, Tax Fairness Oregon believes that there should be limits on how much we give away from tax subsidies and how it impacts education. We feel that we shouldn't be paying for cleanup sites if it's going to impact education. So we think that that would be a simple fix, is to basically the abatement of property taxes should not afford funding. That could be in Section 2. Secondly, probably a little more complicated is the definition of orphan sites. Orphan sites are defined by the DEQ, but often not with the full due diligence. We believe that market forces really should be coming into play as much as possible in these situations, such that, and I'm aware of one particular site where originally it was declared an orphan site by the DEQ, market forces and various other conflicts brought into bear the fact that there was insurance. And in many cases of these dry cleaning sites and gas stations, there is some errors and omissions or insurance. There is some liability insurance. We think that the definition of orphan sites, neither the taxing authorities nor the DEQ has all the resources nor, frankly, the motivation necessarily to always look very deeply for these other sources of funding. So we think that there's one possible fix for this orphan site is to create a wall between declaring the owner of an orphan site is to have it transferred at a nominal charge to the taxing authority with an assignable deed, such that then it can be transferred to a developer to, and in fact, this wouldn't preclude the previous owner from becoming a developer. And I know of some situations, I have friends doing the remediation business in other states that actually have applied this model. So that would create a barrier between the previous owner and previous interests and really make sure that it's an orphan site and the city or the taxing authority would have the option of doing something with it. The second part of that would be to make sure that it's been out of productive use for a certain period of time so that it's not a real easy, quick flip. Somebody says, all right, we have an orphan site. We don't have anything we can do with it, and we just want to convert it over a short period of time. So a time limit on how long it's been out of productive use would be a reasonable thing to make sure that it's not going to be in a flip situation. And the third point would be limits on the individual sites, and Representative Davis spoke to that. There is no desire to have the large Superfund sites be funded under this and then suck up all the funding the taxing authority that a small jurisdiction might have. So it is possible to put some limits on this, some numerical limits. Now, from my experience, most of the simpler sites, like gas stations and very simple sites, the cleanup is going to be in the order of $50,000 plus or minus. If it's a more complicated site, like some of the dry cleaning sites that have been there, some larger sites, it can get up to a couple hundred thousand dollars. The exact number on that, we've suggested a figure, but of course, that is not, you know, an absolute. So those would be the kind of sideboards that we think would make this a better kind of bill for the people of Oregon and protect essentially school funding. So I think that's, you have my comments or you have our comments in front of you, so I would answer any questions.
Yeah. Do you have proposed language on any of those points you raised, Garrett?
Could have.
Okay.
I didn't propose it in this testimony. Some of it is for example, item one, it could be inserted in there to basically nothing in this shall will be allowed to for the abatement of property taxes shall not be allowed to affect the funding for schools. That could be inserted in there.
Well, what about what I was thinking of was the orphan language you spoke of. I mean, how do you do if you're Coos Bay and you have a gas station that hasn't operated for 20 or 30 years and who knows where the owners are, you know, is that an orphan site to you? I mean,
how
do you deal with that?
You'd have to have a statement in there that it shall be transferred to the taxing authority by the owner or their representative, or, and then this would be legal language that I couldn't say, but by some determination that there is no viable owner, mm-hmm. or there has been no determined owner, but transferred to the taxing authority for a nominal fee. And that could be in Section 2.3, I think.
My thinking on these was that in all of these cases, there is no real viable owner. I mean, nobody disagrees with polluter pays as a philosophical position, but in many of those cases, it is difficult. As you see it, how difficult it is in the Superfund cleanup in the Portland Harbor, and I mean that the legal wrangling on that's been going on for 20 years.
Exactly.
And so that's why I'm trying to. I think this is true. That, you know, we want to adopt that where we can, but if we can't, we still have to figure out how to clean up these sites. So,
correct.
I just don't know what the in-between language would be.
I can't give you the legal language. I'm not an attorney. That would be. But I think that most of these sites where they actually have been lying vacant, there is an owner or there is an owner's chain. There is somebody that owns the site. If it's already been transferred to the city, then it's really not a problem. If it's already just come under public ownership, then it wouldn't be an issue. And if it really is underwater or close to underwater, there should be really no problem. And the owner saying, I can't do anything with the site. I can't get anybody to invest it. I'll transfer it to you and transfer it to the taxing authority. And then, I don't write language to bills, so that would be something that could be put in fairly. It creates a wall between one of the problems, it seems to me, the way I read the bill, is that there is no provision in there for prevention from somebody who's an owner saying, all right, we're going to get the money on the tax abatements, we're going to get agreements on the tax abatements, and then they can still go out and with deeper due diligence find an insurance company, and so they can basically be getting the insurance money as well as getting the taxing benefit. There's nothing in there that prevents that I could see. And that would be the concern.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Randy Tucker and Wendy Johnson.
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I was going to just call your attention to a letter of support that I submitted yesterday that has about 35 organizations listed. It's very similar to what Representative McEwen held up in terms of who's on it. There are a few other people that have added their names to the list since we distributed that floor letter in the House. There's very broad support, and I'm here really as just the celebrity spokesmodel for everybody else. But I would like to try to answer a couple of the questions that were just raised. First of all, the very last point that Mr. Rosenthal just mentioned about there's nothing about insurance proceeds, there actually is. If you look at the bottom of page 4, line 44, the eligible costs that could be repaid, if you will, through a tax benefit would be reduced by by any insurance proceeds, any state, federal, other grant monies, tax credits, insurance proceeds, or legal settlements received by the owner of the brownfield to offset eligible costs for the brownfield. So the public does not pay twice or pay for costs that have already been paid. The comments about orphan sites, to my mind, orphan sites are sites where, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, the owner can't be identified easily. And there was a legislation passed last session, the land bank bill, that authorizes local governments to create an entity that can take control of those kinds of sites without affecting the local government's liability posture. And so I believe that's really been addressed in a completely separate bill. When the public owns a site or the site is an orphan, no one's going to be taking advantage of this program, which is only for privately owned sites, which are the only sites that would have property tax liability. Third, just to be clear, I believe the representatives also mentioned this, but I just want to specify that if you look at page 2, lines 16 through 21, there are three categories of sites that are not eligible to participate in this program. One of them is centrally assessed sites, which I believe line 19 refers to. It has some statutory citations, but that's sites under central assessment. The second is state-appraised industrial property. Those are industrial sites of a value of $1 million or more that are not appraised or by the local assessor. And then finally, federal Superfund sites are not allowed to participate in this program. So this really is aimed at the smaller local sites. As far as sideboards, the intent, I believe, of the sponsors of this legislation, and by the way, this is not a piece of legislation that was brought forward by the Brownfields Coalition, the representatives that spoke earlier, Representative McEwen and Representative Davis, it's their bill. It's they that provided the impetus for this, and a lot of us worked with them to try to make sure that everyone was comfortable with the bill. The intent, I believe, and they can speak to it if they wish, is for the sideboards and some of the particulars of this program to remain at the local level. For the state to be authorizing local governments to create a program that fits their local needs. And there is language on page Page 2, lines 39 to 41, authorizing cities and counties to adopt other specifications for the program other than those that are listed in this bill. There's no requirement that a local government adopting this program provide 100% tax benefit full property tax exemption. They can provide a partial property tax exemption. They can make it last for fewer than the number of years that are allowed under this statute. There are lots of ways for local government, looking at their own local situation and at their own, the contaminated sites within their jurisdiction, can protect themselves through due diligence and understanding of what their resources are and their needs. So I would just bring those few points to your attention in response to the comments that have been made, and I'd be happy to answer any further questions. And there are numerous people in the room, I believe, that helped to work on this legislation, including Ms. Johnson to my left. So.
Thank you, Chair Haas. Members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I had the pleasure of working with Mr. Tucker and a large coalition over the interim to work out the details of this bill. The League supports the bill, and our member cities do as well. It is a local option with we believe, enough sideboards to really make this work well. There are two components for the incentive. It's a special assessment of the land and then an exemption of improvements and personal property. But the key is that it's capped at the cost. So there isn't, testified, there isn't a dollar amount cap, but there is a cap in terms of costs, and there's also a year cap. The default is 10 years, and you can get an additional 5. So the max is 15 years for this incentive with both the special assessment of the land and the exemption of the property. So it has that sideboard. That's the default. A city or county or port could lower the 10 years. And the city or county, frankly, could put how much they're willing to have that incentive be. They could put a cap on it. But we really didn't want to put a dollar amount because each property varies so much. And as Representative Davis explained, it's really the margins property, and it's hard to figure out exactly where that line is. But we think some communities will use it, and they may set a cap to make sure they don't have too much erosion of their tax base. But I think it's important to remember this: there really isn't generally an erosion because these properties are vacant and not bringing in any tax revenues. And so as we discuss the issue, there's really two big benefits. You get the property that has the brownfield developed and back into production and bringing in property tax revenues, but it also has an impact on the neighboring communities, the neighboring properties, to increase the value of those properties. So if I go through the three points that Tax Fairness brought up, the first one was about the K-12 funding. We have to remember that we're, you know, getting 40% of nothing is still nothing. And so if we get the brownfield back on the roll, then the school districts would be getting that property tax value. So we think that's important. And the bill does require 75% of the taxing districts to agree to the program. So the school districts would be involved with that decision. The second point was on the orphan sites and transferring to a government entity. As Mr. Tucker explained, we had the land bank bill last session. So these truly orphan sites can be transferred to a government entity like the land bank, but we also heard in the House that sometimes government owns these properties. Klamath Falls had one that was brought up, and you want to transfer it back to a private owner because the city doesn't have the money or the county doesn't have the money to clean it up either, and so providing this incentive will allow some private developers to take that property and develop it. So we need it to go both ways, and so this bill is really about the incentive program. It's not about who owns the property so much, although the third piece is that this law requires DEQ compliance. So if there are already agreements in place, you can't be outside of those agreements. And if there's an order, court order requiring cleanup, I mean, you just don't know, you're not eligible. So we don't have to deal with those issues as well. And then the third issue that was raised by Tax Fairness was the size, and I've already mentioned that. There's the 10-year default. You can get an additional 5, but there's a cap on costs. But our cities and counties and ports can set a different amount to actually cap the incentive. So I think all of the sideboards are really there that were raised. This is seen as an incentive to deal with the small properties, and there are over 13,000 brownfields in Oregon. This is targeted. It won't address the three excluded areas, but we think it needs to be tried. There obviously more robust programs in other states that are using large tax credits on the income tax side, but that would coming out of the general fund. This is coming out of our local funds, but we need to get these properties back on the rolls, and the communities can tailor it. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you both for your testimony, especially for addressing those concerns. We're going to close this public hearing. We need to move on here. Okay. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4084. We're going to carry over a work session until tomorrow and probably this week. So thank you. Thank you all for working on this, especially to Reps Davis and McHugh. And I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 4110, a public hearing and work session on House Bill 4110. This is the EITC bill, and we'll get a brief summary from Chris. And I know Rep. Smith, Rep. Benz is here to talk about one of the amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4110A, as it is before you, contains one policy piece and one technical correction. The policy piece is that it increases the Oregon earned income tax credit from 8% of the federal credit to 11%. For taxpayers with a dependent under the age of 3, it would apply to tax years 2017 through 2019. And the technical fix relates to the property tax, and it modifies the definition of the term conveyance so that they are not so that partial transfer of property to certain entities is exempt from the requirements under ORS 311.411. That's a technical fix from a bill passed in 2015.
Okay. The A9s.
Sorry. Do you want me to talk?
Yes.
Sorry. Okay. The dash A9s deal with an issue related to an energy conservation project that ran into some problems with the recent events in Harney County, so it grants a 2-month extension to the pre-certification for that project, and there is no revenue impact.
Representative Benz, thank you. Apologize for the delay. I thought we were going to not have that bill, but you saw it on revenue and you got to see it again. So
I did.
You're becoming an expert on brownfields.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Haas and Vice Chair Boquist, and thank you for this opportunity this morning. My name is Cliff Benz. I'm state resident from District 60, which includes, among many small cities, Burns. The Judge Grasty is in, I think, Washington, D.C. today, or he would be here with me testifying to the need for the 2-month extension of the period of time allowed to perform the installation of a conservation project in Burns. The idea underlying the request for the credit is to put in a new replacement energy system for a number of the public buildings, the school, perhaps the hospital, but more likely the courthouse. And everything was going smoothly until the occupation, and this slowed things down dramatically because, of course, barricades went up around the courthouse, and there was no way to proceed with either the survey or ultimately the installation of the trenching. It's really, I think, a single instance. I don't think we need to think, I hope we don't have to worry about this repeating itself anyplace else. So the idea is an additional 60 days to complete the project. It's kind of interesting. It's just a small little community. Much of what has to be done needs to be done by the judge. And Steve Grasty is the judge, and of course he was hugely, I hate to say occupied, distracted with these issues, and simply couldn't get away from all of the challenges that were facing him to look at things like this. And so he's asking for basically these 2 months, and I'm joining him in that request.
Well, I think you're right in our initial conversation. If there was ever an excuse or an explanation, this is a pretty good one. Questions of Representative Benz on the A9s? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Bruden here is one of the authors of the original, the base bill on the EITC.
Good morning, Chair Haas and committee. Sorry, I just got in here. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm State Representative Jeff Reardon, District 48, for the record. I don't want to repeat a bunch of information that you already know. I have a very nice talk I can give you about the wonderfulness of the earned income tax credit. But if you're already sold, you know that it works, it's really good for families, it's good for economic development, I can save your time. But I'd be happy to give that presentation if you wish. So what would you like? The base, the bill, talk just briefly about the bill or the background on earned income tax credit?
Well, I think we're pretty well familiar on the mechanics. Questions of Rep. Reardon?
Maybe he just hit the bill highlights. Okay. We've had multiple meetings on.
I think most of us
are sympathetic to this issue. So
okay.
Maybe you just tell us what this specifically does.
Specifically, this bill is trying to take advantage. We had a limited amount of funds available, and I was told to work with around $10 million. What can you do with that? And that's, you know, we had a choice. Broad brush approach where we could give just a tiny benefit to a larger number of families, or narrow it down. And so my bill focuses that, takes it from the current 8% to 11% for families with children under 3 years old. So it's very, that's one of the things we really like about it. We can focus it to that degree. And that should serve about 40,000 families.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
During the main session, we had excruciating discussions on this. Any thought given to, especially given the actions of both chambers recently, this month, thoughts in the future of refundable quarterly? You know, we've had different ways of how do we, this helps them towards the end.
You know,
any thoughts on the way forward outside of this of how do we help those people quicker than the end of the year?
Thank you for your question, Senator. There were discussions. Representative Bence had a proposal that would divide the payments up into 12 months. The idea, of course, getting the money into their pockets immediately. I was told, I don't know the details, to be honest, that that's very challenging to do that. The other thought from personal and from what I've read about this, and it's debatable, of course, but is that there's really one of the advantages of the federal EITC is they get that lump sum. Mm-hmm. And so that's money, maybe you call it forced savings. I don't know what you call it. But that, so they have a lump sum they might not ever have otherwise. It takes it out of that monthly and puts it into something that could be used for an emergency. Maybe it is the car repair, the safety seat for the child or whatever. But you know, that's a luxury that I had when I was a kid or first coming along. I had a couple $1,000s in the bank, and that saved me many times. And I always got in the habit of putting that money back in to keep it up, so I had that little bit of a float. And I would love to see families be able to get to a point where they're more self-sufficient. Maybe they can get to a place where they're not just one paycheck away from pushing a grocery cart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. No questions? Well, you have a very receptive audience up here, and so thank you for your work. We've got some other people who want to speak.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your support.
The legendary Patty Whitney Wise.
That's legendary.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. Patty Whitney Wise, Director for Partners for Hunger Free Oregon and staff to the Oregon Hunger Task Force, soon to retire at the end of April. So, yes, legendary. I'm here to support House Bill 4110. Normally, Matt Newell-Ching would be here in my place, our Public Affairs Director, who's taking over the policy work for me. He had a sick child this morning, so he apologizes. I'm happy to be here, though, because, as you know, this is a bill, and this program is one that I've supported for many years. The thing about this bill and targeting young families, there's been some good research in recent years that shows that first 1,000 days for a child is the most significant time for brain development, and stress really can have an impact on children during that time. So anything we can do to lessen that stress really helps those kids develop and gives them a better shot at doing well in school and in work. The EITC studies have shown that families who get EITC, their kids do better in school, they earn more when they're adults. In fact, one study shows that for every dollar spent in EITC, the children earn more than a dollar in future wages. So I think the return on investment's great, and it's a really good program. There was a work group last session that worked very hard on this concept of targeting additional resources to families with young kids, and this is a chance to begin that work. It's too bad Senator Boquist stepped out. I just wanted to add that in terms of the idea of monthly payments, we're working with Representative Hayden and others on looking to see if that's possible with the child care tax credit. There are a few problems. One of the reasons the feds don't do monthly EITC anymore is that some families ended up having to owe money back at the end of the year because they work irregular hours, and so the money they were getting back each month exceeded what they were actually allotted. And this is really hard for a low-income family to have to pay back money. So we're interested in seeing if there are ways of working a monthly model that would not penalize the families, but at this point that's still the case. So we'll continue working on that in the interim for sure. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions of our witness. Patty, neither here nor there, but one of the concepts that Senator Boquist and I, along with Dr. Warner, worked on as a possible compromise to this ballot measure that's coming down the pikes on corporate taxation includes a huge expansion of the earned income tax credit. You're aware of that, okay? And it's probably five times bigger than this, so.
Yeah. We would be very supportive of that.
And I almost want to say food for thought, but for you, that might not be the best answer. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Happy retirement. Something tells me that you won't be too far from this issue while you're out fishing and golfing.
Or playing with my grandbaby back in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Jess Daly and Jeremy Rogers.
Jeremy's out on a conference call.
He's on a conference call, sir. Maybe he'll make it back in. Maybe not. Thank you, Chair and Committee. My name is Jessica Daly. I'm a Master's of Public Policy student at PSU. I work with Beverly Stein at the National Policy Consensus Center, and I've also been working on the Oregon Business Council's Poverty Task Force, and closely with Representative Reardon and Representative Kenny Geyer to look at the EITC over the last year, and we've done a lot of research. I know you're all familiar with the issue, so I'll try to keep it short. I have a lovely cited page of facts for you, and I'm going to go through the ones that are most important to finance right now. The EITC is a powerful tool, and the small increases proposed here today have the potential to bring more economic benefits as the costs in early childhood care and education are rising dramatically. The EITC is found to reduce poverty overall. It lifts half of the children whose families receive the credit out of poverty. And this is two studies done. One is at the National Bureau of Economic Research, and the other is at the Economic Policy Institute. We also found that 60% of EITC claims go to single filers with children. Children of color whose parents received the EITC experience a 30% reduction in poverty levels. And studies at Harvard reveal that the EITC has multiple positive impacts on child achievement, both academic and social. This impact seems to increase the earlier in life the child receives the credit. The National Center for Children in Poverty at Columbia University examined issues in states like Oregon. Oregon is one of only five states that places a tax burden on people living below the poverty line. They recommend substantially increasing EITC for families living in poverty who are most adversely affected by aging tax codes, as the EITC is the only mechanism in place that can immediately adjust the tax burden of Oregon's working poor. Information from the Brookings Institute shows that EITC dollars are generally spent in the local region on immediate needs. The city of San Antonio estimated that for every dollar received in EITC, they received $1.58 in local economic activity. In 2014, the federal EITC brought over $570 million into Oregon. It's only being claimed at 73%. It's estimated we're leaving about $124 million federal dollars on the table, and we're dead last in utilization. And some states, in order to increase utilization of the credit, have introduced a tiered system for families. And among states with a refundable credit, the average is 21.3%. Ours is, I believe, it's been bumped up to 8. So Oregon also has more people living in poverty than during the 08-09 recession, even though we're experiencing economic growth rates at higher than the national average. And this legislation is especially important in a state where 45% of children live in low-income households, and we have over 600,000 people in poverty. Thank you for the chance to share this information. I'm happy to answer any questions. And as I said, there's more facts in the actual testimony, and I urge you to take a look.
Thank you, Jess. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
On this bill, we also have the dash sevens, I believe, the dash nines. And Barry, I think that's why Barry Pack is here. And if you give us a quick summary, Barry, if you come up and.
Sure. Mr. Chair, the dash seven modifies language pertaining to the duties of the director and deputy director for the Department of Revenue.
Okay.
Great. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Barry Pack with the Department of Administrative Services. And as your staff have noted, this is not, this amendment does not deal with the earned income tax credit, but rather the requirements and the qualifications for the director of the Department of Revenue. Current law requires that that director be skilled and an expert in all matters, in matters of taxation. And while we view that to be a very important set of experience and background for any director of the Department of Revenue, we're not sure that it is the sole determiner about whether or not a person should be qualified for that position. And in fact, it narrows our ability to do recruit a diverse and broad pool of experienced leaders to head up this organization. As you know, Jim Buchholz recently retired from his position as the director of the Department of Revenue, and so we are in the process of beginning a recruitment for a permanent replacement. His deputy is currently acting in that interim capacity. And so we're asking you to consider adding this amendment to that bill so that we can broaden the pool of applicants to include folks who have also have experience in budgeting, in finance, in agency leadership and management. The amendment simply adds the words or financial administration to the qualifications of the director and the deputy director. And with that, I ask for your support, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Appreciate you coming by with that explanation, Des. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Barry. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4110, and I'll carry over a work session until tomorrow or later this week. And Paul? We are adjourned.